The following Dharma talk was recorded in January 2015 near Kansas City, Missouri. It is one of three recordings from the annual New Year's retreat taught by Robert Brummett. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Robert Brummett has practiced insight meditation since 1988 and conducted retreats since 1995. He received a Vipassana facilitator training from Shinzen Young and graduated from the Spirit Rock Community Dharma Leader Program in 2000. Robert is one of the founding members of Mid-America Dharma. He lives in Kansas City and teaches at Unity Institute and Seminary near Lee's Summit, Missouri.
This afternoon I want to talk to you some more about awareness of mind states and also about awareness of the body and the relationship between the two and the importance of each of those practices and how they work together. In becoming aware of the body, body awareness, we intentionally infuse the awareness into the body. So the metaphor that I often use is, if you can imagine putting a dry sponge in a bucket of water and having that sponge soak up the water, that's kind of the way we infuse the body with awareness. We want to directly experience the body. We don't want thinking or imagery or anything in the mind to intervene. See, most of our experience with the body is mitigated by the mind. We have an image of the body. We have an idea of what the body is, what it should be. And our experience of the body is largely conditioned by that mental image. It's part of the reason why people that have had amputated limbs will still have an itch on their hand that's not there any longer, or an itch on their toe if their leg is missing. The itch is in the mind. It's not necessarily in the physical organism itself, you see. So we do have sensations in the body, and those sensations are usually filtered through the lens of the mind. And typically what happens is we have an experience in the body, and immediately the mind goes to work figuring out what it is, whether it's serious, whether it's terminal, whether it needs medical attention, what we need to do about it, etc., etc., you see. Without even really exploring the sensation in the body, the mind is typically reacting to it. And all of that's part of our survival mechanism. You know, when we lived on the savanna or wherever we came from, that's the way you survived, was to recognize certain forms and images. And if it was an image that looked like a predator or an enemy, you had to react immediately. If it was an image that looked like food, you'd react in a different way. So that's deeply conditioned into our brain, that we have an experience and immediately the conditioning of the mind will respond to that experience. And for the vast majority of human beings, that's how we live our life, in response to the conditioning of the mind as it reacts to all the stimuli all about it. And to the extent that we do that, we're really not living in the reality of the present moment. We're living in the unreality of the past. Not only our dim biological past, but also our personal past, our personal history. I remember as a child being bitten by a big black dog. And it was decades into my adult years when I could still feel my body reacting every time I saw a big black dog. Well, even if I knew it was friendly, even if it was a friend's dog, and it would come up to me wanting to be petted, my immediate response was one of fear. So in this practice, what we want to do is to experience the body, excuse me, as directly as possible, so that a sensation is just a sensation. It doesn't need to be interpreted or analyzed. Now, there are exceptions, of course. If you're having a heart attack or if you're choking, you would need medical attention, of course. But anything short of something that's life-threatening, why, we need not do anything other than be simply present to it. So yesterday I think I mentioned that this is often called bare attention, direct attention, immediate attention. It's what Suzuki Roshi would call the beginner's mind. You know, we're experiencing something as if for the very first time, as if we'd just been born. What is this body? What are these forms out here? What does it mean to be alive? Just experiencing directly. And we need to do this because most of the time we tend to live a fair distance from our body. We tend to live just in the upper floor. We don't live in the rest of the building. It's as if we lived in a penthouse apartment and we only visited the other floors if they were on fire or if there was a plumbing problem, you say. Then we go down and fix it, then come back up to where we live. That's basically the way we treat the body. It's an instrument, kind of like our car. In fact, in some schools of dream interpretation, the car is sort of an image for the body, the vehicle, the body. We learn to vacate our body and move into the penthouse of the mind, because at a very young age, it seemed to be too painful, too scary, too difficult to live in the body. So we moved out. For most of us, it happens slowly. For many of us, it happens quite suddenly if we're traumatized in some way. But even just growing up in this culture, we learn very quickly to anesthetize the body and to treat it as an instrument. And men and women do it differently, but I think we both do it. And it's done differently in different cultures, but it's still done in most every modern culture, anyway. So when we come to retreat like this, oftentimes the first several days are spent just moving down a few floors, just kind of exploring the rest of the building. And sometimes when we do that, we see why we vacated it in the first place. You know, maybe it's kind of smelly down there. The plumbing's been broke for a long time. Or maybe it seems to be dangerous or infested with rats, or maybe there's a homeless person living down there. So we discover all sorts of things that maybe we'd rather not see. But the price that we pay for vacating our body is a diminished aliveness, a separation from nature. Our modern culture sees itself basically as isolated, separated from nature, separated from the universe. We've been told that we're nothing but intelligent apes walking around on a piece of rock that's just one insignificant little flake of dust in the great meaningless cosmic universe. That's the scientific view of who we are. So we pay a huge price for leaving our bodies. And we pay a huge price for being identified with the mind and the mind states. And because we have left the body, we have become identified with the mind. And oftentimes we become identified with a particular mind state or a particular collage of mind states, if you will. Our personality tends to coalesce around certain mind states. Some of us tend to be more fear-based. Some of us tend to be more anger or aggressively based. Some of us are more based around sadness and loss. We can often see that in other people. It's a little more difficult to see it in ourselves because we're in the midst of it. Because we're in the midst of these mind states, we don't see them. And yet they very much define our perspective of reality. There's a Zen proverb that says, what the water is to the fish, what the ocean is to the fish, the mind is to the human being. And the fish knows nothing but the ocean. And the human being knows nothing but the mind. The fish doesn't realize there's a whole new world up there. Doesn't even know there's an up there. Doesn't have any idea of what dry land is, you see. And so when we're identified with our mind states, we have no idea that there's anything beyond these mind states. We are literally imprisoned by them. The mind state becomes the lens through which we see the world, through which we see what we call reality. It's almost like we have colored glasses on, fear-colored glasses or anger-colored glasses or loneliness-colored glasses or whatever. So in recognizing the mind state, we begin to see that there's a difference, or a potential difference at least, between the lens and the reality on the other side of the lens. That maybe there's a reality bigger than the particular picture that my mind has created of it. Maybe this building I live in is much, much bigger than I can even imagine. And I'm living in a tiny room in the attic, peering out this little window, thinking that's all there is. How do we disidentify from the mind state if we're embedded in it? Well, there's a number of ways, and I think perhaps the best way, and at least within the context of this practice, I think the best way is to become aware of the body. When we're grounded in awareness of the body, then we get we have the ability to have a more objective view of the mind. When we're caught up in an emotion, for example, I think we've all had this experience of being caught up in, let's say, anger. And we're really caught up in the story of how they screwed us over and how bad they are and what we should do about it and how they should be punished, etc., etc. And then maybe we're fortunate enough to have a Dharma teacher or a psychotherapist or somebody that says, hey, just breathe for a little bit, feel your body. What's going on in the body? Oh, what body? Oh, this, oh yeah, there's a body here, right? There's something besides the story. Wow, there's a body. I feel all these uncomfortable feelings in my body. Tension, hurt, sadness, all sorts of stuff in my body. And as I do that, then the story tends to lose its grip. And I'm not as captivated by that story. Yeah, maybe what they did was wrong and maybe I need to do something about it. But it's not nearly the big deal that it was before. It's not the end of the world. It's not my total reality. When we run away from something, we never really run away from it. We just turn away from it. We put it behind us and pretend that it's not there. But the problem is, the world out here is a mirror of what's back there. And what I'm unwilling to see within myself, i.e. behind me, metaphorically, I'm going to see out in front of me. And maybe that's why we're here in human form, I don't know. Very possible that this physical world is simply a mirror for all that we're unwilling to look at prior to now. So we come into this physical form and we come into the house of mirrors. Wow. That doesn't look like me. That can't possibly be me. So sometimes our suffering is what teaches us. The great gift of suffering is that it shows us where we're out of touch with reality. You know, just like if there's pain in the body, it often means that there's something that needs attention. The body's telling us something. Well, if there's pain in the psyche, i.e. suffering, sometimes it's our psyche that's saying, hey, take a look at this. There's a stone in your shoe. There's a thorn in your thumb. There's a beam in your eye, to use a biblical expression. So when we find something in the world that's consistently problematic, we can use that as a signal. Maybe there's something in my mind, my psyche, that I have pushed down. That's one way of discovering what we've pushed into what Carl Jung would call the shadow. Another way is to come to a Vipassana retreat and just sit and pay attention to the body. And what's unfinished will begin to find its way to the surface. It's an interesting phenomenon how that happens. Because in actuality, the psyche is always trying to press into our awareness what we're not seeing. You know, it does it through dreams, it does it through projections, does it through various symptoms in relationships and in the body. But most of the time in our everyday life, we're defended and we're distracted. We believe the problem's out there, or there's something we can do to fix it or ignore it or avoid it or distract ourselves from it. But in a retreat setting like this, we minimize the distractions and the escape routes, and we just sit here, not running away. And it's kind of like a bucket of muddy water. You know, if you have a bucket of muddy water, what's the best way of clarifying the water? Letting it sit. Let it sit for a few days. The mud will settle to the bottom. You've got clear water. You can siphon it off. Well, it's very, very similar to what we're doing here. Only the mud doesn't sink to the bottom. The mud comes to the top. That's the only difference. So oftentimes it shows up first in our body. Sometimes it shows up in the mind and the emotions before it shows up in the body. What do we do with it when it comes up? Well, basically nothing. The most important thing that we do is what we don't do. We don't run away like we usually do. And we look for all of the ways that we typically run away. You know, we want to read something. We want to talk to somebody. We want to eat something. We want to go to sleep. We want to get lost in some kind of internal drama. Those are all of the ways that we run away. And when we're in the world, I mean, the world offers itself to us as a cornucopia of ways to run away. It rewards us for running away. I heard Pema Chodron give a talk once where she talked about the three R's of mindfulness practice, and I thought it was very astute. And the first R she mentioned was that was recognize. So recognizing a mind state, and recognizing if and how we want to run away from it. Oftentimes, we're more aware of that than we are the mind state itself. All we're aware of is, I want to get up and run. I want to bolt. So recognizing the mind state, recognizing how we want to avoid or defend against that mind state. And the second R stands for refrain. So it's about what we don't do. Mm-hmm. We don't run away. We don't go to sleep. We don't eat that piece of chocolate or whatever. So we do nothing. But doing nothing can be much more difficult than doing something at times. So that's the second R. That's the refraining. The second R, by the way, doesn't stand for repress. Okay? We're not talking about repressing. We're talking about being fully aware and fully open to whatever's arising. But to refrain means I don't duck it, I don't run away from it. And repression is one of the ways that we can run away from it. We can just pretend it's not there. And that's typically the way we learn to run from it in the first place, is to repress it, to deny it. And the third R stands for relax, which means basically to open up to it. Open the body, open the mind. There's anger, and I'm all uptight, and I hate it. Can I relax? And relax and allow whatever is in there to show up. Behind the anger, there may be some tears. There may be some fear. There may be some shame. Whatever is said. When we relax, the mud rises to the top. Now there's a fourth R that I've added. This is not Pema Chodron's construct, but my fourth R stands for repeat. Repeat the first three over and over again. Because it's an ongoing process. The Buddha talked about five defenses that are particularly pernicious in the sense that they tend to keep us asleep. They keep us unconscious. And so to be particularly aware of these five, which he called the five hindrances, these are mind states which can keep us in delusion for a long time. And we've talked about some of them already, and I would bet you've experienced every one of these, maybe in the last half hour. The first is craving. Craving what's not here. Craving is a way of avoiding what is here. Have you ever had the experience of craving chocolate or something like that? And discovering that behind that you're feeling lonely or sad? And that the craving was just a diversion? Because the chocolate only keeps the sadness at bay for a little while. Then we have to have another piece. So craving is a way that we avoid the reality of what's here. Aversion is another one. Aversion means resistance, pushing away. I can't stand this. It's driving me crazy. I got to get out of here. That's aversion. Craving's a little more subtle. We often don't see craving until we're acting it out. Aversion usually is right in our face. It's a little easier to see. A third one goes by a number of different names. It could be called sleepiness or unconsciousness. The traditional name that's given to it is sloth or laziness. But it doesn't mean physical laziness necessarily. That can be part of it. I mean, it can be literally, the inclination to fall asleep. It's not uncommon at retreats, even if we're well rested, to become very sleepy all of a sudden. I'm always suspicious when I get sleepy, only while I'm sitting, you know. Once the bell rings, my energy's back, you see. Time to sit again. Okay. So you can use that as a signal, you see. I mean, if you're really sleepy and your body needs rest, you'll be sleepy all the time. But if you're only sleepy when you're on the cushion, then let be aware of that. There's other ways of being sleepy, and that is just of distracting ourselves, spacing out. Sometimes it can be real pleasant. You know, I've had people at times in conferences, and I'm not talking about anybody here at this retreat, but I've heard people say, I had such a good meditation. I mean, I was just so blissed out. It was really great. I said, well, what were you aware of? Oh, I wasn't aware of anything. I was just gone, you know. It was just so great, you know. You know, and I would say, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. But I'm not sure what good it's doing you other than maybe giving you a little bit of rest that you may need. But a lot of time that's what the way people actually see meditation is, a way of kind of having a pleasant nap while you're sitting up. And of course in our everyday life with our cell phones and our televisions and all of our devices, I mean, that's a classic way of going to sleep. You know. A fourth hindrance is that of agitation. And agitation basically means restlessness. The restless body, the restless mind. In the mind, agitation is just the mind skipping all over the place, what some people call the monkey mind. Just boom, 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 boom. So it was scattered. It's almost like when you drop a water on a hot skillet and you can see it bouncing around. That's the way the mind is. It's like the proverbial cat on a hot tin roof. And sometimes we can experience that in the body as well. There's a Yiddish word for it. It's called the spilkas. And it's when you have sort of like the ants under your skin. It's when you have the... When I was a kid, I used to call it the heebie-jeebies. You know, it just... Like my pants were on fire. Couldn't sit still. That's a hindrance. That's an avoidance, you see. And a fifth hindrance, and this is one to really watch out for, the Buddha would say, and that is doubt. And the reason why this can be the most deadly is that it can be most likely to bring our practice to a halt. His doubt is when we have a loss of faith in the practice. And doubt can show up in a lot of subtle ways. You know, is this really doing any good? Or I think I'll skip this sit, you know, I've got a headache, or I'm kind of tired. I really question the validity of this practice. You know, maybe Sufi dancing or something like that is what I need. I need something a little more active and lively. And I'm not saying that may not be true, but I would be very suspicious. I think we all know some of the spiritual dilettantes that will spend 2 weeks in every spiritual practice available. So whatever your spiritual practice is, you know, when we lose faith in it, when we don't do it, I'm too busy. That's a good one. Just don't have time. Or what good will it do? I'm all scattered. My mind's scattered. Or I'm tired. My back hurts. But the classic line is, what good will this do? When you find yourself saying that, you can hear the doubt bell go off. And even though that's the most deadly, it's the easiest to remedy, to remediate. That is just to put the tush on the cush. To sit on the cushion, to do the practice. Just do it. Just do it. And I'll talk more about this at the close, but making your practice as regularly a part of your life as eating a meal. You know, people say, I don't have time to meditate. Did you have time to eat? Oh, yeah, I ate, you know. Okay, good. Glad you're there. Did you use the bathroom today? Oh, yeah, a couple of times. Got time for that. Okay. So you do have time. It's just a matter of priority, right? Well, yeah, of course. Yeah. So, and I'll talk more about the specifics of that, but just doing it, that's really the great antidote for doubt, to do the practice. And regarding the hindrances, it's really important that we don't see the hindrances as a mistake or a sin or something that I shouldn't be doing. That Judeo-Christian kind of sin concept is very strong in our culture. And even if you don't buy the religion or the philosophy, it still can seep in. And I know a number of people that say, well, I'm just caught up in craving and I shouldn't be doing that. You know, I shouldn't have these desires. Well, if you shouldn't have them, they wouldn't be there, you know. So it's not about should or shouldn't, it's what's here. So the good news is that when we see a hindrance, we're on our way out. We're on our way of being free of it. So when you see craving, when you see aversion, when you see sleepiness, agitation, when you recognize doubt, that's not bad news, it's good news. It's when you don't see it that it can be problematic. So that's the interesting thing with this practice, is in many ways the bad news is the good news. You know, we're so deeply conditioned to think, I should sit here and feel good all the time and do it right all the time, and my mind's not supposed to wander, you say. Well, if you did that, you probably wouldn't be getting anywhere. You know, it's when we're struggling and our back hurts and we're recognizing craving, we're recognizing aversion. Even though it's difficult, if we can see that without becoming entangled in it, that's when the work is really, the work of freedom is occurring. So again, the work is just to recognize, not run away from it, relax and open up to it and be present in the moment. Come back to this breath. Just this breath is enough. Just this moment. Just this life that I've ignored until now. But no more.